Eoch Tanuyap, Kwiget Iwans, Kwiens Na. Hi everybody, my name is Kwiget Iwans. I'm a member of the Squamish Nation and the Yogalanis clan of the Haida Nation. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. We live, work, play, and broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations.
A little over 3 weeks has passed since it was announced publicly that Mountain Equipment Co-op was bankrupt. In 3 weeks, a member-led campaign with 150,000 signatures, a hugely successful GoFundMe campaign, a cross-country cooperative legal battle, and now a court ruling. Mountain Equipment Co-op is no more. Sure, it exists, and the stores will be open, but it cannot call itself a co-op, a member-led organization. Tonight on Each for All, we continue our search for answers as to how we can stop this from happening again to other co-ops. We begin with an update on the campaign and legal ruling. Later, we return to our cooperative sector check-ins to find out the important issues for co-ops as we head into a provincial election during a pandemic and look at economic recovery. You're listening to Each for All, the Cooperative Connection, broadcasting from unceded traditional and ancestral territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. This is 100.5 FM in Vancouver, live online at cooperadio.org. Download this episode and others at our site, eachforall.coop. This is Katie Lang with The Season of Hollow Soul on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Waving boughs so slowly dance, questioning why. Fate must have a reason. Why else endure the season of hollow soul? The ground on which we
I guess we're feeling a bit nostalgic here on Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. I'm your host, Robin Puga. In our evolving coverage of the Mountain Equipment Co-op insolvency and sale, we have heard its rich history, explored its governance, discussed the legality of the board's move, and shared the story of what members were doing about it. The legal application to delay the sale was dealt a blow this week in BC Supreme Court. The ruling allows the sale of MEC to Kingswood Capital Management under the company's Creditor Arrangement Act. Tonight, we bring you the latest update on the Save the MEC campaign. So happy to have on the call with us tonight, Kevin Harding. He is one of the main organizers of the SaveMEC.ca campaign. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
No, it's my pleasure to be with you, Robin, and especially to be with you on Co-op Radio.
And so we heard this week that the court ruling came down. I guess we heard Friday last week that the court ruling came down. Can you tell us what exactly the court has decided?
Yeah, it's not the outcome that we were hoping, but it's an outcome that is maybe not the most surprising. The judge didn't give us a huge amount of details in the hearing on Friday. She just said that our application, which was a request to pause the sale of Mountain Equipment Co-op's assets, was dismissed, and that the application of the purchaser and of Mountain Equipment Co-op to get authorization for the sale was approved. She didn't provide reasons or background or anything really. It was just the words dismissed and approved, which means that a written decision will come out later that we can look through and understand a little bit more. The only other thing that the justice really said in her ruling was that she recognized that there was a tremendous amount of passion that had been evidenced through the process, and particularly by members. So that's something that I heard, and I felt that we were heard to some degree, but that the, I guess, the legal opinion and the legal analysis of the case, as we knew from the outset, was an uphill battle, and it's one that didn't turn out in our favor. We certainly held hope, and we had a very strong argument, to be honest. In these kinds of proceedings, what happens, and what happens frequently, is that people who can put together an alternate bid for a sale, a group of purchasers can come in and present an option to the court that says, we've got another option here. The one that you have in front of you is not the only one. Consider our other option. And then there can be a hearing to see if the second option, the alternate arrangement, is something that would work. And that's what... that's really what we spent 3 weeks pulling together. And we had more than $110 million of offers from people who were interested in supporting the co-op by purchasing the real estate, providing an operating loan, social impact investors who were willing to put money into it. The challenge that we had was that ours was all contingent on needing 2 weeks to look through the books, where the sale to the American private equity firm was prepackaged because they'd had time to look at the books already. And MEC was keeping the books secret, even from the member owners, which was the disappointing part. So we thought we had a chance. We thought we made a really strong argument, but the law is just written in a way that doesn't favor co-ops or member owners.
So what's next for the SaveMEC.ca campaign?
Yeah, we had last night on the 5th of October, we had a really great town hall meeting where we brought together about 350 people from all across the country. That was kind of stunning in and of itself. And we gave a bit of a brief legal update, answered a lot of the questions that came up around, can we appeal? You know, we're looking into that. Are there other options? But the really exciting news that we had was that there's sort of three pathways that we're looking forward to go. One of them is building on a lot of people's excitement nationally about co-ops, and potentially just building a whole new outdoor equipment co-op, name yet to be determined, and all of that. But there's some people who have been involved in the co-op sector for a while, and people who are just getting involved in it now that want to build something new. Another option that we're looking at as sort of a second project is monitoring this process, because we don't have an indication yet that the co-op behind Mountain Equipment Co-op will be dissolved. In some court filings, we know that the name will be changed, which is odd, but because of trademark reasons. But that co-op will theoretically still exist at the end of this process. It will still have 5.4 million members. It will still have a corporate history. And it should still have a December annual general meeting. And if we're building a new co-op in one project, but we can rescue the shell co-op that won't have any assets in another, we might be able to build something with that momentum. And then our third project that we're looking at is working with partners across the social economy sector and with people who are incensed that something like this could happen to a co-op. It's to build an organization to push for the rights of people who are involved in social enterprise and co-ops and fight for legal change, but also educate on best practices. What does it mean to be a social entrepreneur and be responsible to democratic business? So we've got hundreds of volunteers that are filling out forms and saying where they want to be involved, and we're looking forward to seeing what we can build.
That's fantastic. I'm really excited to hear all of that is coming out of this massive push for the last 3 weeks. I really appreciate all of the efforts that you've put into this, and I'm really excited to see where it does go. And if it's a completely new outdoor equipment cooperative, sign me up today.
Yeah, that's what we've heard from a lot. No, we'll be happy to share as much of this as we can going forward. We're just sort of in the setting it up stages, getting our volunteers all together. The volunteers are amazing. None of us would have been able to do it without the group effort that went into this.
Well, kudos to everybody's effort. Thanks so much, Kevin. I really appreciate you informing our audience as well about how things are progressing.
My pleasure, Robin. Always happy to join you.
All right. We'll talk to you again soon.
Each for All continues to seek answers into how did this happen, and how can we stop this from happening again to other co-ops. Stay tuned next week for another update. Tonight is our monthly check-ins for October 5th, 2020. My guests tonight are John Kay, President of the Board of Co-ops and Mutuals of Canada and Vice Chair of the BC Cooperative Association and CEO of Realize Strategies Co-op. Tom Armstrong also joins us. He is the CEO of the Co-op Housing Federation of BC, and he shares the latest news on the co-op housing developments. Ross Gentleman is the former general manager of CCEC Credit Union and a blogger on credit union matters at cufutures.ca. Let's get started.
It's great to see you all again and to have a sector check-in, because I feel like all we've talked about for the last 3 weeks has been Mountain Equipment Co-op. However, I don't think we're going to get away from talking about that tonight. I do appreciate your time, though.
Thanks.
Good to be here.
Good to be here as always.
So it is a little over 3 weeks since we had the announcement that Mountain Equipment Co-op was being sold to a U.S. investment firm. This came as quite the shock and surprise, I think, to everybody, except for a very small handful of Mountain Equipment Co-op managers and board members. John, the court decision came down this last week, and it is not in favor of staying the sale. Can you tell us a bit about that decision?
Yeah, well, we know about as much as you've just said, Robin. Madam Justice Fitzpatrick ruled on Friday morning that she was allowing the sale to proceed and dismissing the arguments that CMC, the BC Co-op Association, the Alberta Co-op and Community Association, and Save MEC brought to the table. And that's honestly about all we know at this point, Robin. We know that she thanked us for our passionate advocacy on behalf of the members, but she ultimately approved the sale. We're expecting that her written reasons for judgment will be released sometime this week, and then we'll get a better understanding as to exactly why she ruled the way she did. Our best sense internally is that ultimately, Madam Justice Fitzpatrick took the view that the duty of the court is to protect the secured creditors, and the Companies Creditors Arrangement Act allows the courts to essentially set aside any provincial law, anything that would, you know, protect the rights of members or shareholders or anything else. And, you know, we came, I think, as I'd said to you before, Robin, with a pretty strong beginning of an alternative financing plan for MEC. I mean, we had something on the order of $130 million worth of commitments, I think, that Save MEC lined up.
Wow.
But, you know, it wasn't firm enough because it relied on people being able to have a look at the books, have a look at the data, and then make hard commitments. So, you know, it was Kingswood coming in with a, you know, straight up, here's how much we're going to pay offer, versus our side saying, well, we've got a soft commitment of $90 million from these guys and $20 million here. And that unfortunately just wasn't enough. You know, it kind of feels like one of those political campaigns where the leader stands up and says, if we just had 3 more weeks, guys, we could have won this thing. Mm. And it honestly kind of feels like that.
Mm-hmm. And it sounded like the pressure on the judge to decide in favor of the sale, the argument sounded like it was that if they didn't move quickly, they're going to essentially risk all of the jobs disappearing because of, you know, lackluster sales over the holiday season and there being this ambiguity leading into this important season for a retailer.
Yeah, that's right, Robin. There are a couple of pretty hard pressure points on this thing. One is that the Royal Bank of Canada had a credit facility, a loan that expired on September 30th. So they wanted their money back, and by one means or another. So that was putting some pressure on, I think, on the court to make some decisions. And also, MEC apparently is losing about $500,000 a month right now. But on top of that, the cost of the CCAA process is apparently about $1 million a month. So, and that's a charge going against the sale, and every month that this process plays out, it just adds more cost and more potential impact to MEC financially. So there were some pretty compelling things that were pushing the judge to, I think, to need to make a decision based on what she had in front of her.
Okay. And we have a bit of an update from Kevin Harding on the Save MEC campaign. Is there anything that you want to point out that you think or feel optimistic about for the future here?
Yeah, I do, Rob. And I think the thing that we had been hopeful for is that there would be grounds for an appeal. I wouldn't say that is absolutely off the table yet, but based on the legal advice we've received to date, that appears that there's probably very little likelihood of success in us doing that. And there's some pretty big risks. Number one, we risk the possibility that the Court of Appeal upholds the current judgment. So twice we've been basically told that, yeah, the rights of the members are enshrined in provincial law, but bankruptcy proceedings will always take precedent over that. Two, that we may have needed or may need to put up some fairly significant financial security for an appeal. And again, partly because of these costs that are being incurred during this this process. So, it would be great to be able to appeal and win, but that might not be the best way to proceed. So the optimistic and really hopeful thing is that now we've got an opportunity to shift into the political arena. Because what we've learned is that provincial cooperative law isn't as strong as it could be. It doesn't do enough necessarily to protect the rights of members and to force boards of cooperatives to engage members in a situation like this. And it's a little more challenging, but there also is an opportunity to think about working with the federal government to amend the Companies Creditors Arrangement Act so that if we find ourselves with another co-op insolvency or situation like this, that there would be a requirement in the case of a cooperative for members to have a vote before the court can simply bless a sale. So, that's a longer term process that engages potentially legislatures all across the country, plus parliament. But it does feel like there's an opening for that conversation, certainly here in BC. Mm-hmm. But from the early days of conversations with the federal government, it sounds like there's an opportunity there as well.
Okay, I'll jump in. What the hell? We've given John enough time. Thanks for the good update, though, John. I'm going to have to contest one thing with you here. I'm not sure that there will be much of an appetite to change the law to give co-op members a kind of a privileged position in certain circumstances. The situation for co-op members is not unlike the situation for shareholders in an ordinary company or a publicly traded company. Their interests are shoved off to one side, and it's the creditors' interests that take priority.
Yeah, that's a fair comment, Ross. And I would say in response that it's not easy. There's certainly been some receptivity in Ottawa, if I can put it that way. There are some strong champions like Lucy Moncion, who spoke in the Senate about this last week. On the other hand, you're right, there are some potential for unintended consequences. And additionally, there's a real potential that bankruptcy lawyers in the country might have a real problem with the idea of creating a special carve-out for cooperatives. So, I don't want to say it's a slam dunk or anything, but simply that based on some very initial conversations, there is at least an openness in Ottawa to hear what we have to say, whether it results in change is another matter. And I think based on some conversations before the writ was dropped here, I think if the NDP is reelected, there will be an openness to talking about, so are there changes that could be made to the Cooperative Association Act in light of MEC that would be sensible, practical, and would achieve the objective of protecting member rights, but obviously recognize that bankruptcy processes also have their own their own legal entanglements and need to be considered alongside of cooperative laws and principles.
Well, and we really can't lose sight of the fact that this was not something that just happened in the last 3 weeks. This has been happening probably for like the last 15 years with Mountain Equipment Co-op. It's been a what I am sensing from the research we've done here on the show is a bit of a cultural shift in that time period, where it went from, and I'm sure, you know, there's changing retail landscape at the same time, changing habits of people purchasing. There's a lot of stuff happening in that ecosystem. But how do we address that? Is there a way to do that outside of the acts and stuff? Like, is there not a reconciliation about accountability within a cooperative structure that was just kind of whittled away and ignored eventually?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, Robin. I mean, you know, we look back to, yeah, this was a long time in the making. To some degree. On the other hand, I mean, MEC was recording a cash profit until 2018. And the real impact was COVID. I mean, that's what really drove the need for this sale, as I understand it. But, you know, there are issues with governance here, right? Mm-hmm. There's issues with a board that didn't necessarily see the need to engage the membership along the way. But, you know, there's also problems within the organization itself. I stopped at the store in Winnipeg a couple of days ago and talked to one of the workers there on the floor who said, you know, I used to work at MEC 20 years ago. And now, if you ask any of the people working here in the floor, it's just another retail job. There's nothing that distinguishes it as being a co-op. Nobody really knows. Nobody really cares, to be honest about it. So I think we have a big job as a co-op sector to do in training and education and awareness raising, not just with the wider Canadian public, but even with our own organizations.
Mm-hmm. I think I'll jump in here because I think there is a longer history here to the project. And one of the points you just made, John, is interesting, that the on the ground culture within the enterprise changed over time. And that was because of the expansion and the building of the brand into a national brand. And really, the ambitions of management to expand and grow the business.
Yep.
So one of the things that crosses my mind is whether there ought to be some provisions either within the law or within the co-op's basic rules that really give members a more important voice when the credit union wants, the credit union or credit co-op in that this context, if the co-op wants to expand dramatically, or particularly if they want to go outside the province in which they're based.
Mm-hmm. Well, oh, I could more, Robin. Or sorry, Ross.
And so, Ross, I mean, it's nice to add these things to the rules. The Mountain Equipment Co-op apparently had rules that said a massive sale of assets needs to be brought to a special resolution of the members. That's also in the act. It has no teeth. So how do we give it teeth?
Well, I think that's the bankruptcy proceedings or creditors arrangement activities. I'm thinking more about what happened 10 and 12 years, 15 years ago, when they started adding numerous retail locations outside of the province of BC, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I might play something of a devil's advocate on this, because everyone's looking around for you know, reasons and where to point the finger. And ultimately, isn't it true that, you know, while the co-op governance model is fragile, mm-hmm. when it's wrapped around some of the more, you know, the broader corporate requirements that it exists in, it only and ever will survive as a consequence of the vigilance of members who think of themselves as stakeholders in the co-op. And, you know, and I know from reading the history of MEC, there's no doubt that it was driven by mission and co-op principles in the 70s. But, you know, I moved to BC in 2000, and I one of the first things I did was walk into Mountain Equipment Co-op, because they actually were proud to have the word co-op in their name then. And because I'd heard about it, and I walked in because I wanted to be a part of it. And I got to the till and they just added $5 onto my purchase. And I walked out with a bag, you know, with a Gore-Tex jacket and a pair of hiking boots. And in that experience, no one ever spoke to me about what it meant to be part of a co-op, a consumer co-op, and no one ever has. So, you know, I think people should ask themselves over the last several years, you know, if you're a member of, say, Costco, what's been different about your experience as a member of MEC and a member of Costco? And, you know, because I was, you know, in Costco over the weekend, and I'm was thinking back, and I think, you know, they're, other than the fact that they sell lousier outdoor recreation apparel, Costco isn't really that much different in the way it engages its customers as opposed to its members. So, you know, I think it really does come down to co-ops as a vehicle for overcoming adversity, overcoming exclusion or oppression, work really well as long as the members are grounded in the mission and motivated to keep their membership alive and active. And as soon as the reason for that starts to fade into the background, you're at risk. And whether it's, you know, the sale to an American financer or the demutualization of a wheat pool, it really comes down to the same thing. The members don't perceive that to be crucial to their interests anymore, whether they be economic interests or social interests. And that, to me, is the job of leadership in the co-op system and movement, is to keep that bond between members, shareholders, elected officials, and others strong and vibrant. And the minute you lose that, you're in the news.
Well put. I think you are right on the money. It's not institutional provisions of the bylaws or the legislation. The culture really is key. And in that context, I think MEC was unique. Not only was it the largest co-op of its kind in Canada, but the fact that it tried to serve 5 million members with a board of 9, you've got quite a remote relationship between those who are representing the alleged owner members. Yeah. and the membership itself.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, we are, I believe, seeing a trend in larger cooperatives to lose that connection and education of members into what is a co-op. Is there, and we've talked, I guess, a little bit about how do we turn that tide. Is there anything actionable that the co-op movement, the co-op sector wants to do? John, you kind of alluded to some additional education for, but what would be a practical thing to do?
Yeah, well, like I said, Robin, one of the first things that the co-op sector wants to do is to look at legislative reform. I agree with what Ross and Tom have said, but there's also, I think, a need, and we've certainly been hearing a lot of interest on the part of members to look at strengthening legislation. So that's one. Two, I think, is to talk to the membership of the associations to get a sense from them of what we can do. I mean, we've talked about education, we've talked about culture, we've talked about thinking about how to manage co-op businesses differently so they're not on, you know, kind of runaway breakneck growth. Practically, how do we do those things as a movement, as a national set of members and associations? I don't know the answer yet, but I think those are the logical next steps.
Okay.
Let me jump in with one more thought here, because I think one of the things that we dance around, and I think it's not an easy one for us to deal with, but one of the groups, actually, there are two groups who seem to benefit a little from a lack of vigilant membership. The accountability of management and directors back to the membership is weakened as you have these large masses of members who have little or no interest in the business that's going on. So you have this, not only this distance, but this freedom that's granted to management and freedom that's granted to directors. And I think as we pursue some of the conversations that you're alluding to, John, you have to appreciate that some of those people really don't want to give up the liberties or the freedoms and independence that they currently have because their members are not particularly scrutinizing what they're doing.
Yeah, well, that's fair, Ross. And by the same token, we've been hearing from a lot of the largest co-ops in the country a lot of concern about MEC and what it means for the cooperative sector and what we do about it. So yeah. I think it can kind of cut both ways. And, you know,
good.
There will be, as you know, as the devil is in the details, I'm sure some of the things you've talked about will emerge, to be sure. But I think there's also a lot of worry that this does threaten the integrity and the things that make the cooperative model different, namely the democratic control by members. You know, even if that was very weak in the case of MEC and maybe in others for that matter.
Well, I was impressed that it was less than a week ago I received an email from Coast Capital soliciting my feedback on new product offerings. And at the end, I asked what we could do better for our members. I was like, whoa, it's Coast Capital. So maybe this is a wake-up call for cooperatives, I hope. I do want to turn our attention away from mountain equipment co-op, because I mean it is the most exciting thing to talk about in co-ops for a while, but we do have a provincial election coming up October 24th. I don't know, I'm registered to vote, that's all I know. Mm-hmm. I believe. I'm looking to find out what are the important issues for cooperatives coming up in this provincial election, and are people talking about them? Tom, housing is always top of the list.
Well, we sure hear people talking about them. In fact, this is a great day to be chatting about this because the NDP just released its platform earlier today. So people started getting phone calls from people involved in the campaign to see how the messages were playing, and it's interesting for me because Housing Central, the Co-op Housing Federation, and BC Nonprofit plan to release our central campaign messages or asks in the next 48 hours. And it will now be a little anticlimactic because platform of the former government, the NDP, will already have addressed most of our major concerns. We're waiting for the Liberal housing platform to be released in more detail, and the Greens, of course. But we've been looking for three things. One is to accelerate the historic provincial investment in housing. You know, the government had made a 10-year commitment, a $7 billion investment in to produce 114,000 affordable homes over 10 years. We'd like to see that commitment maintained, but the delivery accelerated to front load those dollars and those homes by the end of the new government's mandate, whatever that turns out to be. Secondly, you've heard that we've been pushing very hard the notion of an acquisition program, a well-capitalized fund that would allow the community housing sector to buy and renovate private rental housing stock, move it into the community housing sector, and make it permanently affordable. We were thrilled last week to hear all three parties endorse that proposal. So we're waiting now to see how it can be made to happen. And the third, I think it's time to, I think we had to give ourselves a little wake-up call on this one. It's time to say, as part of a provincial housing platform, we need to commit to the bold action it's going to take to end homelessness, period. And let's not search for the perfect weasel word to deal with that blight on our social conscience and our economic sustainability. Let's not talk about reducing homelessness or tackling homelessness or fighting let's end homelessness. We have the resources to do it. We know what has to happen in order for that to be accomplished. Let's commit ourselves to doing it. And I would say any party that doesn't commit itself to that goal is unworthy of the mandate of leading British Columbians after the next election.
Wow. Your call to action on homelessness, are we saw a lot of movement during the beginning of the pandemic to essentially find people safe spaces to be staying. Are you seeing that potentially piggybacking that effort Can we piggyback on that to end homelessness across the province?
Absolutely. And that really has been the catalyst for this conversation. We now know that we can mobilize government resources to purchase hotels or lease temporary accommodation to provide the wraparound supports that people need to find that initial roof over their heads. And then it's a question of marrying up housing and health outcomes, dealing with a permanent alternative to the poison drug supply on the streets, so that people get a chance at a stable future, and then to end the systemic racism that's built into our housing and health and other systems, and deal with populations that have been even more marginalized than others, and deal with that once and for all as part of a coordinated strategy. So the pandemic absolutely was the catalyst, or maybe the proof of concept that showed us that it can be done. There's no walking back from that now. Let's all agree on that. And it's time for a government to commit itself to ending homelessness by 2030.
Well, I mean, that is something exciting to consider further. Have you heard any platforms that are close to that?
I doubt that anyone will put it in such stark terms. We would argue that it's time to do exactly that.
Well, for cooperative housing, you're asking for some accelerated timelines around affordable housing through Housing Central. For co-op housing specifically, is there any specific asks? I know we'd had some provincial input on helping bridge some of the subsidized housing in cooperatives. Is that continuing? Is there new asks in that area?
No, you know, we didn't have to ask. As part of the election campaign, the government did step up and bridge those missing federal dollars until the end of this calendar year. And that was two extensions on the initial commitment they made. Minister Robinson wrote a very strong and supportive letter to Minister Hussein at the federal level. He just responded yesterday, but through Evan Siddall, the president of CMHC. And the response was essentially, talk to us after the election. and they threw a bit of a crumb by saying, we're going to wait until April of 2021 to see how the expenditures under the existing subsidy program are going for those co-ops that didn't get caught by the arbitrary deadline. And if we have a few cookies in the cupboard still in April of 2021, we'll consider moving the eligibility criteria to include co-ops that came to the ends of their agreements before April of 2016. So a very tepid response to a very strong advocacy from the provincial minister. So, you know, all co-ops really need is to be at the table. Co-ops don't need any special kind of subsidy or assistance that, broadly speaking, nonprofit or community housing needs. We just need to be recognized as a legitimate partner in the enterprise of developing community and affordable housing. And I think we see that. Both the CEO of the BC Nonprofit Housing Association and myself got invited to provide a briefing on affordable housing development to the City of Vancouver Council just this last week. And that to me was a recognition by the staff and the council that they see themselves as partners with the community housing sector and are willing to engage with us in that kind of conversation about how to bring deeply affordable and permanently affordable housing to the market. So we were very happy with that. And nobody I've been able to speak with has any sense of what's going to unfold on the evening of October 24th. All I know is I've got a board meeting on the morning of October 25th. And typically the board would expect me to open the meeting by reviewing what had happened on election night. And I don't think we're going to know, because the way the mail-in ballots are going to trickle in, I'm hearing people say now that we may not know for 2 weeks after election day, who won the election, who might form the government.
Interesting.
So now maybe that will change. Maybe the systems will be tweaked to give us a bit more, an earlier idea, but I honestly don't know what it's going to feel like. I'm used to setting up, you know, three or four TV screens in the living room, ordering an evening full of pizza, and hunkering down until someone declares the result in the last riding to send in the results. I don't think we're going to have that kind of entertainment this time. It's going to be a slow process.
Interesting. I do want to ask about the road to economic recovery. I feel like in British Columbia, we're very blessed, and things may not be as bleak as they are in other parts of the world. Are people talking in Victoria about cooperatives and how they might play a role in economic recovery? I'm curious to know if anybody has heard anything about that.
Not specifically, Robin. BCCA has been having a series of conversations with, prior to the election, with various ministers about a series of initiatives that we would like to see the hopefully re-elected NDP government seize on. One of them is paralleling what the federal parliament did with Motion 100 and mapping out a comprehensive strategy for the cooperative sector in BC. One piece that is more economically focused is looking at where government and the sector can partner together to convert small and medium-sized enterprises, especially in rural communities, to cooperatives, so we can ideally preserve those jobs and that economic activity. And there have been some emerging conversations as well about childcare and how we can lever off of the commitments that the NDP made to childcare and really deepen the involvement of the cooperative sector in the delivery of affordable childcare. So those conversations were all just really starting to take root, and then the premier dropped the writ. So, but they were promising. There was a lot of very receptive feedback from the ministers and chiefs of staff that we were talking to.
Well, I guess we'll just have to see what happens after October 24th.
We taking bets on the outcome?
I can chip in on the question of recovery a bit. Mm-hmm. Not so much on the front of co-op development, but I know the credit union system has had several serious conversations with the Ministry of Finance over the last month and a half, 3 months. Championed a proposal to the provincial government that would allow the government to guarantee certain kinds of loans to supplement the financing arrangements that the feds have put forward for small businesses primarily, but that would include co-ops, I'm sure. That larger proposal was adopted in part as part of the NDP recovery plan, but that's where it sits at the moment as we wait out the election. So, but there was a fairly substantial proposal put forward by the credit unions, and we got a reasonable response from government at that time.
Okay. Well, it's interesting to hear that co-ops are in that conversation around economic recovery. I mean, obviously, credit unions are holders of much financial capital and assets. So it makes sense they're in that. I'm curious, Ross, is there a time frame that people are talking about yet?
Time frame for which?
For economic recovery.
Well, the proposal I think that's on the table, the plan that the NDP put forward, is looking for the 6 to 12 months. So it's a longer term plan, but everything depends on the outcomes of this election, and I don't think we're going to see much decided in the way of election and then reorganization of government and get everything up to speed into late November, early December. So we'll see. Things are on hold.
There's a couple other subjects. Is there anything else that we should talk about?
Maybe I'll chip in. On one other front, because I really appreciate Tom's position. I think that the co-op housing sector is pretty clear in establishing asks and policy proposals on that front. From the credit union sector, I'm a little disappointed because the credit unions of BC have not got together and do not have any particular proposals or requests or positions that are being advanced. It's been a bit of a disappointment for me. I was working with the Cooperative Credit Union Association on this front last week and trying to say, are we going to be proposing anything? And it is a little bit of a disappointment for me, but we'll see. Individual credit unions may be stepping up in their own territory and working with candidates or MLAs in their own territory.
Ross, do you have, I know we were talking earlier about larger co-ops. One of the large co-ops that I mentioned was Coast Capital. Like, these are financial cooperatives, and we are always seeing a tendency in financial co-ops to become larger.
Yep.
You'd mentioned in an email earlier today that there are more credit union mergers on our horizon.
One has been made public. That was made public, I think it was only last week, that Alder Grove Credit Union is pursuing serious merger talks with Gulf and Fraser, otherwise known as GNF Financial, Gulf and Fraser Credit Union. Both of them have been around for a long, long time. They're both in the order of 70 years old, and they have long histories. Gulf and Fraser is now approaching $3 billion in assets. The Alder Grove Credit Union was a substantial entity in and of itself at $750 million in assets. So the merger, if it proceeds, will be one more significant agglomeration within the credit union system. That credit union will probably become the fifth largest credit union in the province.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
There are two other conversations being pursued in private, so I can't speak to those, but the merger talks that were initiated more than a year ago in the Kootenays continue to proceed. So there are six credit unions there that I think are still discussing and proceeding with proposals to their individual memberships. That's the Kootenay Savings, East Kootenay Savings, East Kootenay Community Credit Union, the credit union further east, Heritage Credit Union, Casigar, Grand Forks Credit Union, Nelson Credit Union, and so on. So that's a pretty large multi-party negotiation.
Interesting. Wow. Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see what their plans are for maintaining member engagement. Tom, I wanted to circle back on housing because we got a couple updates from you as well. I was curious to hear if the city lease renewals have been discussed, if there's any movement of that. We heard lots of talk prior to COVID, but I haven't heard any updates lately.
Well, I can give you one as of yesterday. We're on track now for city council to hear a report from staff with recommendations on a framework for lease renewals at its meeting of November 25th. So, and as we know now, time is a relative thing in a pandemic, and that's going to feel like tomorrow. But a really interesting thing happened just recently. I have to say the city staff team, I mean, I'll preface this by saying we're no closer to an agreement. So that's the sobering news. But the city staff team has been more open and transparent and welcoming of a close exploration of the options they've been floating than I've ever experienced in 20 years of dealing with the city of Vancouver. And that's a credit to the management team driving that process. They've opened up the process to facilitate our engagement. But what's even more remarkable to me is they've agreed to something that I've not ever seen happen at the city. We've talked about the options that were built into that discussion paper they released back in January. And you know that we could not find a way to get any closer to endorsing any of those four options than we were when we first read them in the paper. And at some point, we were moved to say, based on the advice of a counselor, to say, look, why are we beating our heads against this brick wall? We're never going to persuade you to abandon the four options that you've put forward. You're never going to persuade us to like any of them. So instead of going to council with this stalemate to deal with, why don't you leave your options in the paper exactly as they are and simply add ours? The alternatives that we've been developing to the ground rent formula advanced by the city. And it took them a couple of weeks, you know, to think about it, because, you know, it was a pretty bold proposal. And a couple of days ago, they got back to us and said, you know what, we're going to do that. So, you know, let's get some help from you in framing the alternatives that you think are a better deal for co-ops than we've advanced in the paper. We'll bolt them into the paper. We won't recommend them. In fact, we'll spend some time in the paper explaining why we don't like them. But we'll put it all to council. In fact, we'll release it at least 3 weeks before the council meeting. And then we can all have a good kick of the tires, you know, privately, publicly, with council, with staff. And on November 25th, in what shapes up to be a very interesting council meeting, we'll see where we're at, and we'll get council to make a decision. And I think that's remarkable. You know, I really, my hat is off to the city staff who, and any other issue we've engaged on, would have just dug in and said, no, if you want council to be aware of your recommendations, you can show up, put your name to be on the speakers list on November 25th and have your 5 minutes in the sun. And they haven't done that. So, you know, who knows how it's going to turn out. I know that we'll be spending many a long evening with our members between now and November 25, going over the options, examining different ideas. And then when the report does come out in early November, that will be a very intense 3 weeks as we talk to ourselves about what we can live with and what we can't, what might work as an amendment to the proposals, what might not. but, you know, really, that's how democracy is supposed to work. Mm-hmm. You get a bunch of ideas out on the table, you take a run at them, you see which ones work and which ones don't, and then the people who are elected to decide do. And I'm totally comfortable with that, and I can't wait to get busy.
Interesting. Well,
I mean, we're already busy, but I can't wait to actually have something concrete to talk to about our members with.
Yeah, that's awesome. So
this sounds great, but I have to ask a couple of thoughts cross my mind here. Mm-hmm. One is, what is the impact of Sadu Johnson's departure play? How does that play in here?
It shouldn't delay it.
Okay.
And on the substance of the alternatives being floated, I don't think it will have a real impact, because most of the decision making has been made by the steering committee that's eventually going to be in charge of the Vancouver Affordable Housing Endowment Fund. Now, Sadu does chair that committee, but there are more general managers on it. But I don't think there are any surprises in the ideas that are coming forward. So. You know, they'll all get surfaced and they'll all get debated, and then we'll see how it goes.
Okay. Thanks.
I know. I will say, it's also the mayor himself has become personally involved in the issue. He's been meeting in like a round table format with various housing co-op representatives. And I think he's been struck by the passion displayed by the co-op members. He's been impressed with how articulate they are in defense of their interests. And he's been struck by the fact, that of 54 leasehold co-ops, not a single one has been willing to step forward and say they endorse any of the options that are currently known to be in the paper. So he's waiting for a solution that someone, anyone, will endorse as well. And that's what we are about.
Awesome. Well, looking forward to hearing about that. And we'll check in November and see how things are progressing when they release the report. We are coming to time, and I probably have to wrap up here. Anybody have anything else they want to sneak in under the wire?
Come to our education conference on October 31st.
Okay.
Online.
Where can people find info?
chf.bc.ca.
And John was just saying the BCCA AGM next week.
Yes, so don't forget the details are on bcca.coop. So for members, please register and show up.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Great to see you all happy and healthy.
Yeah.
Good to see
you,
everyone.
To see you all.
Nice to you.
Take care.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
So long.
That was our panel discussion on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver. And that's it for us this week on Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. I'm your host, Robin Puga. I would like to thank our guests, Kevin Harding, John Kay, Tom Armstrong, and Ross Gentleman. Tune in next week for more updates on the evolving Mountain Equipment Co-op story, more election coverage, and news from the co-op and social economy. Get involved in the MEC campaign. Visit savemec.ca, sign the petition, and we'll see if we can get more support for this campaign. 5.4 million of us are members, and we deserve to be heard. This is Each for All, the Cooperative Connection on Vancouver Co-op Radio. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can reach us at ideas@eachforall.coop or tweet us on Twitter @eachforall. Our website is eachforall.coop, and we'll have this episode posted there shortly. Thank you for listening, and a special thank you to all the frontline workers in this difficult time. We really appreciate all your efforts and sacrifices. Have a cooperative week out there. We look forward to talking with you again in 7 days.
and you're listening on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio. Keep on listening, baby.